The large map of Terrebonne, spread out on the table in front of her and held flat by four lamps, gave reason enough for worry. Markers covered it, red wedges for Shanshan forces on the move, and red stars for forces holding in place, each supporting a small paper banner inked with their numbers and composition. Scattered across the map, across the entire map, lay black disks marking engagements, and even more white disks for enemy forces, many of those without the banners. How could there be any enemies in Terrebonne? It was as secure as... "What happened?" she demanded.
"Rocken began arriving with reports from Lieutenant General Turan about 3 hours ago," Galgun began in conversational tones, pointedly not making a report himself. He studied the map as he talked, never glancing in her direction.
"They aren't complete. Each new one adds to the lists, and I expect that won't change for a while, but what I've seen runs this way. Since dawn yesterday, 7 major supply camps overrun and burned, along with more than 24 smaller camps. 20 supply trains attacked, the wagons and their contents put to the torch. 17 small outposts have been wiped out, 11 patrols have failed to report in, and there have been an additional 15 skirmishes. Also a few attacks against our settlers. Only a handful of fatalities, mostly men who tried to defend their belongings, but a good many wagons and stores burned, along with some half-built houses, and the same message delivered everywhere. Leave Terrebonne. All this was done by bands of between 200 and perhaps 500 men. Estimates are a minimum of 10,000, and perhaps twice that, nearly all Terrebonners. Oh yes, he finished casually. And most of them are wearing armor painted with stripes.
She wanted to grind her teeth. Galgun commanded the soldiers of the Return, yet she commanded the Karen, the Forerunners, and as such she possessed the higher rank in spite of his crest and red lacquered fingernails. She suspected the only reason he did not claim that the Forerunners had been absorbed into the Return by its very arrival was that supplanting her meant assuming responsibility for Tuon's safety, and for that apology should it become necessary. Dislike was too mild a word. She loathed Galgun. A mutiny, she said, proud of the coolness of her voice. Inside she had begun to burn. Galgun's white queue swung slowly as he shook his head.
No. All reports say our Terrebonners have fought well and we've had a few successes, taken a few prisoners. Not one of them can be found on the rosters of loyal Terrebonners. Several have been identified as Dragonsworn, believed to be up in Arad-Daman. And the name Rodal Iteralda has been mentioned a number of times as the brain behind it all. And the leader, a Damani. He's supposed to be one of the best generals this side of the ocean, and if he planned and carried out all this, he swept a hand over the map, then I believe it.
The fool sounded admiring. Not a mutiny, a raid on a grand scale, but he won't get out with nearly as many men as he brought in. Dragons sworn. The word was like a fist clutching Suroth's throat.
Are there Ashaman? Those fellows who can channel?
Galgun grimaced and made a sign against evil, apparently unconscious of doing so.
There was no mention of them, he said dryly, and I rather think there would have been.
Red-hot anger needed to erupt at Galgun, but screaming at another of the high blood would lower her eyes, and, as bad, gain nothing. Still, it had to be directed somewhere. It had to come out. She was proud of what she had done in Terrebonne, and now the country appeared to be halfway back to the chaos she found when she first landed there. And one man was to blame.
This Iteralda, her tone was ice. I want his head. Never fear, Galgun murmured, folding his hands behind his back and bending to examine some of the small banners. It won't be long before Turan chases him back to Arad-Daman with his tail between his legs, and with luck he'll be with one of the bands we snap up.
Luck, she snapped.
I don't trust luck.
Her anger was open now,
and she did not consider trying to suppress it again. Her eyes scanned the map as though she could find Iteralda that way.
If Turon is hunting 100 bands, as you suggest, he'll need more scouts to run them down, and I want them run down. Every last one of them, especially Iteralda. General Yulun, I want 9 in every 10 Rakan and Altar and Amadisha move to Tarabon. If Turon can't find them with all that, then he can see if his own head will appease me.
Yulun, a dark little man in a blue robe embroidered with black crested eagles, must have dressed in too great a hurry to apply the gum that normally held his wig in place, because he was constantly touching the thing to make sure it was straight. He was captain of the air for the Forerunners, but the returns captain of the air was only a banner general, a more senior man having died on the voyage. Yulun would have no trouble with him.
A wise move, High Lady, he said, frowning at the map.
But may I suggest leaving the Rakan in Amadisia and those assigned to Banner General Kirgan? Rakan are the best way we have to locate Aiel, and in 2 days we still haven't found those white cloaks. That will still give General Turon...
The Aiel are less of a problem every day, she told him firmly. And a few deserters are nothing.
He inclined his head in assent, one hand keeping his wig in place. He was only low blood, after all.
I hardly call 7,000 men a few deserters, Galgun murmured dryly.
It shall be as I command, she snapped.
Curse those so-called children of the light. She still had not decided whether to make Asunawa and the few thousand who had remained Dako Vale. They had remained, yet how long before they offered betrayal too? And Asunawa seemed to hate Damani of all things. The man was unbalanced.
Galgun shrugged, utterly unperturbed. A red lacquered fingernail traced lines on the map as though he were planning movements of soldiers.
So long as you don't want the Torakan, too, I raise no objections. That plan must go forward. Altara is falling into our hands with barely a struggle. I'm not ready to move on Ilion yet, and we need to pacify Tarabon again quickly. The people will turn against us if we can't give them safety.
Suroth began to regret letting her anger show.
He would raise no objections? He was not ready for Ilion yet?
He was all but saying that he did not have to follow her orders, only not openly, not so he had to take her responsibility along with her authority.
I expect this message to be sent to Turon, General Galgun.
Her voice was steady, kept so by will alone.
He is to send me Rodal Iteralda's head if he has to hound the man across Arad-Daman and into the Blight. And if he fails to send me that head, I will take his.
Galgun's mouth tightened briefly, and he frowned down at the map.
Turon sometimes needs a fire lit under him, he muttered, and Arad-Daman has always been next for him. Very well. Your message will be sent, Suroth.
She could stay no longer in the same room with him. Without a word, she left. Had she spoken, she would have screamed. She stalked all the way back to her rooms without bothering to mask her fury. The Death Watch guards took no notice, of course. They might as well have been carved of stone, which made her slam the anteroom door behind her with a crash. Perhaps they noticed that. Padding toward her bed, she kicked off her slippers, let the robe and sash fall to the floor. She must find Tuon. She had to. If only she could puzzle out Tuon's target, puzzle out where she was. If only... Suddenly the walls of her bedchamber, the ceiling, even the floor, began to glow with the silvery light. Those surfaces seemed to have become light. Gaping in shock, she turned slowly, staring at the box of light that surrounded her, and found herself looking at a woman made of roiling flames, clothed in roiling flames. Alman Daragal was on his feet, awaiting his owner's command to attack.
I am Semirag,
the woman of fire said in a voice like a tolling funeral gong.
Belly, Alman Daragal!
That command, taught as a child because it amused her to have the Lopar prostrate himself before her, ended with a grunt because she obeyed it herself even as she gave it. Kissing the red and green patterned carpet, she said,
I live to serve and obey, great mistress.
There was no doubt in her mind that this woman was who she said. Who would dare claim that name falsely, or could appear as living fire?
"I think you would also like to rule."
The tolling gong sounded faintly amused, but then it hardened.
"Look at me. I dislike the way you, Shanshan, avoid meeting my eyes. It makes me believe you are hiding something. You don't want to try hiding anything from me, Suroth."
"Of course not, Great Mistress," Suroth said, pushing herself up to sit on her heels. "Never, Great Mistress." She raised her gaze as far as the other woman's mouth, but she could not make herself raise it higher. Surely that would be enough.
"Better," Semirag murmured. "Now, how would you like to rule in these lands? A handful of deaths, Galgun and a few others, and you could manage to name yourself Empress with my help. It's hardly important, but circumstances provide the opportunity, and you would certainly be more amenable than the current Empress has been so far."
Suroth's stomach clenched. She feared she might vomit.
"Great Mistress," she said dully, "the penalty for that is to be taken before the true Empress, may she live forever, and have your entire skin removed, great care being taken to keep you alive. After that..."
"Inventive, if primitive," Semirag broke in wryly. "But of no account. The Empress Radhanan is dead. Remarkable how much blood there is in a human body. Enough to cover the whole crystal throne. Take the offer, Suroth. I will not make it again. You will make certain matters slightly more convenient, but not enough for me to put myself out a second time."
Suroth had to make herself breathe.
"Then Tuon is the Empress. May she live."
Tuon would take a new name, rarely to be spoken outside the imperial family. The Empress was the Empress. Might she live forever. Wrapping her arms around herself, Suroth began to sob, shaking beyond her ability to stop. Al-Mandaragal lifted his head and whined at her interrogatively. Semirag laughed, the music of deep gongs.
"Grief for Radhanan, Suroth? Or is your dislike of Tuon becoming Empress so deep?"
Haltingly, in spurts of three or four words broken by unmanageable weeping, Suroth explained. As the proclaimed heir, Tuon had become Empress the moment her mother died. Except if her mother had been assassinated, then it must have been arranged by one of her sisters, which meant that Tuon herself was surely dead. And none of that made the slightest difference. The forms would be carried out. She would have to return to Shandar and apologize for Tuon's death. For the death of an empress, now, to the very woman who had arranged it. Who would, of course, not take the throne until Tuon's death was announced. She could not bring herself to admit that she would kill herself first. It was too shaming to say aloud. Words died as howling sobs racked her. She did not want to die. She had been promised she would live forever. This time Semirag's laughter was so shocking that it shut off Suroth's tears. That head of fire was thrown back, emitting great peals of mirth. At last she regained control, wiping away tears of flame with fiery fingers.
"I see I didn't make myself clear. Radhanan is dead, and her daughters, and her sons, and half the imperial court as well. There is no imperial family except for Tuon. There is no empire. Shandar is in the hands of rioters and looters, and so are a dozen other cities. At least 50 nobles are contending for the throne with armies in the field. There is war from the Aldale Mountains to Salaking, which is why you will be perfectly safe in disposing of Tuon and proclaiming yourself Empress. I've even arranged for a ship, which should arrive soon, to bring word of the disaster."
She laughed again and said something strange.
"Let the Lord of Chaos rule."
Suroth gaped at the other woman in spite of herself. The Empire? Destroyed? Semirag had killed the... Assassination was not unknown among the blood, high or low, nor within the Imperial family. Yet for anyone else to reach inside the Imperial family in that way was horrifying, unthinkable. Even one of the Daconcion, the chosen ones. But to become Empress herself, even here. She felt dizzy, with a hysterical desire to laugh. She could complete the cycle, conquering these lands, and then send armies to reclaim Shanshan. With an effort, she managed to regain possession of herself.
Great mistress, if Tuan really is alive, then killing her will be difficult.
She had to force those words out. To kill the Empress, even thinking it was difficult. To become Empress. Her head felt as if it might float off her shoulders.
She will have her Suldam and Domani with her and some of her Death Watch guards.
Difficult? Killing her would be impossible in those circumstances, unless Semirag could be induced to do it herself. 6 Domani might well be dangerous even to her. Besides, there was a saying among commoners, the mighty tell the lesser to dig in the mud and keep their own hands clean. She had heard it by chance and punished the man who spoke it, but it was true.
Think, Suroth, the gongs rang, strong, imperative. Captain Musenji and the others would have gone the same night Tuan and her maid left if they had had any inkling of what she was about. They are looking for her. You must put every effort into finding her first, but if that fails, her Death Watch guards will be less protection than they seem. Every soldier in your army has heard that at least some of the guards are involved with an impostor. The general feeling seems to be that the impostor and anyone connected to her should be torn apart bodily, and the pieces buried in a dung heap, quietly.
Lips of fire curled in a small, amused smile, to avoid the shame to the Empire. It might be possible. A party of Death Watch guards would be easy to locate. She would need to find out exactly how many Musenji had taken with him and send Elbar with 50 for every one, 100, to account for the Domani. And then,
Great Mistress, you understand I am reluctant to proclaim anything until I am certain Tuan is dead?
Of course, Semirag said. The gongs were amused once more.
But remember, if Tuan manages to return safely, it will matter little to me, so don't dally.
I will not, Great Mistress. I intend to become Empress, and for that I must kill the Empress.
This time, saying it was not very hard at all. In Parvara's estimation, Tsutama Wrath's rooms were flamboyant beyond the point of extravagance, and her own beginnings as a butcher's daughter played no part in her opinion. The sitting room simply put her on edge. Beneath a cornice carved with swallows in flight and gilded, the walls held 2 large silk tapestries, one displaying bright red blood roses, the other a kalma bush, covered in scarlet blossoms larger than her 2 hands together. The tables and chairs were delicate pieces, if you ignored sufficient carving and gilding for any throne. The stand lamps were heavily gilded too, and the mantel worked with running horses above the red-streaked marble fireplace. Several of the tables held red seafolk porcelain, the rarest, 4 vases and 6 bowls, a small fortune in themselves, as well as any number of jade or ivory carvings, none small, and 1 figure of a dancing woman, a hand tall, that appeared to be carved from a ruby. A gratuitous display of wealth, and she knew for a fact that aside from the gilded barrel clock on the mantel, there was another in Tsutama's bedroom and even one in her dressing room. 3 clocks! That went far beyond flamboyant, never mind gilding or rubies. And yet the room suited the woman seated across from her and Javindra. Flamboyant was exactly the word for her appearance. Tsutama was a strikingly beautiful woman, her hair caught in a fine golden net, with fire drops thick at her throat and ears, and dressed as always in crimson silk that molded her full bosom, today with golden scrollwork embroidery to increase the emphasis. You might almost think she wanted to attract men if you did not know her. Tsutama had made her dislike of men well known long before being sent into exile. She would have given mercy to a rabid dog before a man. Back then she had been hammer hard, yet many had thought her a broken reed when she returned to the tower. For a while they had. Then everyone who spent any time near her realized that those shifting eyes were far from nervous. Exile had changed her, only not toward softness. Those eyes belonged on a hunting cat, searching for enemies or prey. The rest of Tsutama's face was not so much serene as it was still an unreadable mask. Unless you pushed her to open anger, at least. Even then her voice would remain as calm as smooth ice, though, an unnerving combination.
"I heard disturbing rumors this morning about the battle at Dumai's Wells," she said abruptly.
"Bloody disturbing." She had the habits now of long silences, no small talk, and sudden unexpected statements. Exile had coarsened her language, too. The isolated farm she had been confined to must have been vivid.
"Including that three of the dead sisters were from our Aja. Mother's milk in a cup." All delivered in the most even tones, but her eyes stabbed at them accusingly.
Pavara took that gaze in stride. Any direct look from Tsutama seemed accusing, and on edge or not, Pavara knew better than to let the highest see it. The woman swooped on weakness like a falcon.
"I can't see why Katerina would disobey your orders to keep her knowledge to herself. And you cannot believe Tarna is likely to put discredit on Elida. Not publicly, at any rate."
Tarna guarded her feelings on Elida as carefully as a cat guarded a mouse hole.
"But sisters do get reports from their eyes and ears. We can't stop them learning what happened. I'm surprised it's taken this long."
"That's so," Javindra added, smoothing her skirts.
The angular woman wore no jewelry aside from the great serpent ring, and her dress was unadorned, and a red deep enough to appear near black.
"Sooner or later the facts will all come out if we work till our fingers bleed."
Her mouth was so tight she seemed to be biting something, yet she sounded almost satisfied. Odd, that. She was Elida's lapdog.
Sutama's stare focused on her, and after a moment a flush grew on Javindra's cheeks. Perhaps as an excuse to break eye contact, she took a long drink of her tea. From a cup of beaten gold worked with leopards and deer, of course, Tsutama being as she now was. The highest continued to stare silently, but whether at Javindra or something beyond her, Pavara could no longer say.
When Katerina brought word that Galina was among the dead at Dumai's Wells, Tsutama had been raised to replace her by near acclamation. She had possessed a very good reputation as a sitter, at least before her involvement in the disgusting events that led to her downfall, and many in the Red believed the times called for as hard a highest as could be found. Galina's death had lifted a great weight from Pavara's shoulders. The highest, a dark friend. Oh, that had been agony. Yet she was uncertain about Tsutama. There was something wild about her now, something unpredictable. Was she entirely sane? But then the same question could be asked regarding the whole White Tower. How many of the sisters were entirely sane now? As if sensing her thoughts, Tsutama shifted that unblinking gaze to her. It did not make Pavara color or start, as it did so many besides Javindra, but she did find herself wishing Duhara were there, just to give the highest a third sitter to stare at, just to share them out. She wished she knew where the woman had gone and why, with a rebel army camped outside Tarvalan. Over a week ago, Duhara had simply taken ship without a word to anyone, so far as Pavara was aware, and no one seemed to know whether she had gone north or south. These days, Pavara was suspicious of everyone and nearly everything.
"Did you call us here because of something in that letter, Highest?" she said at last.
She met that unsettling stare levelly, yet she was beginning to want a long pull from her own ornate cup, and she wished it held wine rather than tea. Deliberately she rested the cup on the narrow arm of her chair. The other woman's gaze made her feel as though spiders were crawling on her skin. After a very long moment, Tsutama's eyes dropped to the folded letter in her lap. Only her hand held it from rolling up into a little cylinder. It was on the very thin paper used for messages sent by pigeon, and the small inked letters clearly visible through the page appeared to cover it densely. "This is from Sachal Anderley," she said, bringing a wince of pity from Pavara and a grunt that might have been anything from Javindra. "Poor Sachal." Sutama continued without any outward sign of sympathy, though. "The bloody woman believes Galena escaped because it is addressed to her. Much of what she writes merely confirms what we already know from other sources, including Tovain. But without naming them, she bloody well says that she is in charge of most of the sisters in the city of Kyrian." "How can Sachal be in charge of any sisters?" Javindra shook her head, her expression denying the possibility. "Could she have gone insane?" Pavara held her silence. Sutama gave answers when she wished, rarely when you asked. Tovain's earlier letter, also addressed to Galena, had not mentioned Sachal at all, or the other two, but of course she would have found the entire subject beyond distasteful. Even thinking of it was like eating rotten plums. Most of her words had been devoted to laying the whole blame for events at Elida's feet, however indirectly. Sutama's eyes flickered toward Javindra like dagger thrusts, but she went on without pausing. "Sachal recounts Tovain's bloody visit to Kyrian with the other sisters and the flaming Ashaman, though she clearly doesn't know about the bloody bonding. She found it all very strange, sisters mingling with Ashaman on tense yet often friendly terms. Blood and bloody ashes. That is how she puts it, burn me." Sutama's tone, suitable for discussing the price of lace, in strong contrast to the intensity of her eyes and her language, gave no hint of what she felt on the subject. "Sachal says that when they left, they took flaming warders belonging to sisters she believes are with the boy, so it seems bloody certain they were looking for him and likely have found him by now. She has no idea why. But she confirms what Tovain claimed concerning Loghain. Apparently the bloody man is no longer gentled." "Impossible," Javindra muttered into her teacup, but softly. Sutama disliked having her statements challenged. Pavara kept her opinions to herself and sipped from her own cup. So far there seemed nothing in the letter worthy of discussion except how Sachal could be in charge of anything, and she would rather think of anything other than Sachal's fate. The tea tasted of blueberries. How had Sutama obtained blueberries this early in the spring? Perhaps they had been dried. "I will read the rest to you," Sutama said, unfolding the page and scanning almost to the bottom before beginning. Apparently, Sachal had been very detailed. What was the highest not sharing? So many suspicions. "I have been so long without communicating because I could not work out how to say what I must, but now I see that simply telling the facts is the only way. Along with a number of other sisters, who I will leave to decide for themselves whether to reveal what I am about to, I have sworn an oath of fealty to the Dragon Reborn, which is to last until Tarmangaiden has been fought." Javindra gasped loudly, her eyes popping, but Pivara merely whispered, "Taviren." It must be that. Taviren had always been her explanation for most of the disturbing rumors out of Kyrian. Sutama read on right over them. "What I do for the good of the Red Aja and the good of the Tower. Should you disagree, I will surrender myself for your discipline, after Tarmangaiden. As you may have heard, Ergain, Fatamed, Ronaila, Vavanios, and I were all stilled when the Dragon Reborn escaped at Dumai's Wells. We have been healed, however, by a man named Damer Flynn, one of the Ashaman, and we all seem to be restored fully. Unlikely as this seems, I swear beneath the light and by my hope of salvation and rebirth that it is true. I look forward to my eventual return to the Tower, where I will retake the three oaths to reaffirm my dedication to my Aja and to the Tower." Folding the letter again, she gave her head a small shake. "There's more, but it's all more bloody pleading that what she's doing is for the Aja and the Tower." A glitter in her eyes suggested that Sachal might come to regret surviving the last battle. "If Sachal truly has been healed," Pavara began, and could not go on. She wet her lips with tea, then raised the cup again and took a mouthful. The possibility seemed too wonderful to hope for, a snowflake that might melt at a touch. This is impossible, Javindra growled, though not very strongly. Even so, she directed the comment to Pavara, lest the highest think it meant for her. A deep scowl made her face harsher. Gentling cannot be healed. Stilling cannot be healed. Sheep will fly first. Sushal must be delusional.
Tovain might be mistaken, Tsutama said in a very strong voice. Though if she is, I can't see why these flaming Ashaman would let Loghain be one of them, much less command. But I hardly think Sushal could be bloody mistaken about herself. And she doesn't write like a woman having flaming delusions. Sometimes what is bloody impossible is only bloody impossible until the first woman does it. So, Stilling has been healed by a man. Those flaming Shanchan locusts are chaining every woman they find who can channel, apparently including a number of sisters. 12 days passed. Well, you know what happened as bloody well as I. The world has become a more dangerous place than at any time since the Trolloc Wars, perhaps since the Breaking itself. Therefore, I've decided we will move forward with your scheme for these flaming Ashaman, Pavara. Distasteful and hazardous, yet burn me, there is no bloody choice. You and Javindra will arrange it together.
Pavara winced. Not for the Shanshan. They were human, whatever strange Tarangreal they possessed, and they would be defeated eventually. Mention of what the Forsaken had done 12 days ago brought a grimace, though, despite her efforts at keeping a smooth face. So much of the power wielded in one place could have been no one else. To the extent she could, she avoided thinking about that or what they might have been trying to accomplish, or worse, what they might have accomplished. A second wince came at hearing the proposal to bond Ashaman named as hers, but that had been inevitable from the moment she presented Tarna's suggestion to Tsutama, while holding her breath against the eruption she was sure would come. She had even used the argument of increasing the size of linked circles by including men against that monstrous display of the power. Surprisingly, there had been no eruption and small reaction of any kind. Tsutama merely said she would think on it, and insisted on having the relevant papers about men and circles delivered to her from the library. The third wince, the largest, was for having to work with Javindra, for being saddled with the job at all. She had more than enough on her plate at the moment. Besides which, working with Javindra was always painful. The woman argued against anything put forward by anyone save herself. Nearly anything. Javindra had been vehemently against bonding Ashaman, horrified at the notion of Red Sisters bonding anyone almost as much as at bonding men who could channel. Yet now that the Highest had commanded it, she was stymied. Still she found a way to argue against. "Elida will never allow it," she muttered. Tsutama's glittering eyes caught her gaze and held it. The bony woman swallowed audibly. "Elida will not know until it is too late, Javindra. I hide her secrets, the disaster against the Black Tower, Dumai's Wells, as best I can because she was raised from the Red. But she is the Ammerlin seat of all Ajahs and none. That means she is no longer Red, and this is Ajah business, not hers." A dangerous tone entered her voice, and she had not cursed once. That meant she was on the edge of open fury. "Do you disagree with me on this? Do you intend to inform Elida despite my express wishes?"
"No, Highest," Javindra replied quickly, then buried her face in her cup. Strangely, she seemed to be hiding a smile.
Pavara contented herself with shaking her head. If it had to be done, and she was certain it must, then clearly Elida had to be kept in the dark. What did Javindra have to smile about? Too many suspicions.
"I'm very glad that you both agree with me," Tsutama said dryly, leaning back in her chair. "Now leave me." They paused only to set down their cups and curtsy.
In the Red, when the Highest spoke, everyone obeyed, including sitters. The sole exception by Ajah law was voting in the hall, though some women who held the title had managed to ensure that any vote near to their hearts went as they wished. Pavara was certain Tsutama intended to be one such. The struggle was going to be distinctly unpleasant. She only hoped she could give as good as she got.
In the corridor outside, Javindra muttered something about correspondence and rushed off down the white floor tiles marked with the red flame of Tarvalin before Pavara could say a word. Not that she had intended to say anything, but surely as peaches were poison, the woman was going to drag her heels in this and leave the whole matter in her lap. Light, but this was the last thing she needed at the worst possible time. Pausing at her own rooms only long enough to gather her long-fringed shawl and check the hour, a quarter of an hour to noon, she was almost disappointed that her one clock agreed with Tsutama's. Clocks frequently did not. She left the red quarters and hurried deeper into the tower, down into the common areas below the quarters. The wide hallways were well lighted with mirrored stand lamps, but almost empty of people, which made them seem cavernous and the frieze-banded white walls stark. The occasional rippling of a bright tapestry in a draught had an eerie feel, as though the silk or wool had taken on life. The few people she saw were serving men and women with the flame of Tarvalin on their chests, scurrying along about their chores and barely pausing long enough to offer hurried courtesies. They kept their eyes lowered. With the Ajahs separated into all but warring camps, fetid tension and antagonism filled the tower, and the mood had infected the servants. Frightened them, at least. She could not be sure, but she thought fewer than 200 sisters remained in the tower, most keeping to their Ajah quarters except for necessity, so she really did not expect to see another sister strolling. When Adelorna Bastine glided up the short stairs from a crossing corridor almost right in front of her, she was so surprised she gave a start. Adelorna, who made slimness appear stately despite her lack of height, walked on without acknowledging Pavara in any way. The Saldaean woman wore her shawl, too. No sister was seen outside her Ajah quarters without her shawl now, and was followed by her three warders. Short and tall, wide and lean, they wore their swords, and their eyes never ceased moving. Warders wearing swords and plainly guarding their Aes Sedai's back in the tower. That was all too common, yet Pavara could have wept at it. Only there were too many reasons for weeping to settle on one. Instead, she set about solving what she could. Tsutama could command Reds to bond Ashaman, command them not to go running to Elida, but it seemed best to begin with sisters who might be willing to entertain the notion without being ordered, especially with rumors spreading of three Red sisters dead at Ashaman hands. Tarna Fair had already entertained it, so a very private conversation with her was in order. She might know others of a like mind. The greatest difficulty would be approaching the Ashaman with the idea. They were very unlikely to agree just because they themselves had already bonded 51 sisters. Light of the world! 51! Broaching the subject would require a sister who possessed diplomacy and a way with words. And iron nerve. She was still mulling over names when she saw the woman she had come to meet, already at the appointed place, apparently studying a tall tapestry. Tiny and willowy and regal in her pale silver silk, with a slightly darker lace at her neck and wrists, Eukiria appeared thoroughly engrossed in the tapestry and quite at her ease. Pavara could only recall seeing her the slightest bit flustered on one occasion, and putting Tallien to the question had been nerve-wracking for everyone there. Eukiri was alone, of course, though of late she had been heard to say she was thinking of taking a warder again. Doubtless that was equal parts the current times and their own present situation. Pavara could have done with a warder or two herself. "Is there any truth in this, or is it all the weaver's fancy?" she asked, joining the smaller woman. The tapestry showed a long-ago battle against Trollocs, or was purported to. Most such things were made long after the fact, and the weavers usually went by hearsay. This one was old enough to need the protection of a warding to keep it from falling apart. "I know as much about tapestries as a pig knows about blacksmithing, Pavara." For all her elegance, Eukiri seldom let long pass without revealing her country origins. The silvery-gray fringe of her shawl swung as she gathered it around her. "You're late, so let's be brief. I feel like a hen being watched by a fox. Maris broke this morning, and I gave her the oath of obedience myself, but as with the others, her one other is out of the tower. With the rebels, I think." She fell silent as a pair of serving women approached up the hallway, carrying a large wicker laundry basket with neatly folded bed linens bulging from the top. Pavara sighed. It had seemed so encouraging at the start. Terrifying and nearly overwhelming, too, yet they had appeared to be making a good beginning. Talin had only known the name of one other black sister actually in the tower at present, but once Atuan had been kidnapped, Pavara would have liked to think of it as an arrest, yet she could not, when they seemed to be violating half of tower law and a good many strong customs besides. Once Atuan was safely in hand, she had soon been induced to surrender the names of her heart. Kerala Sangir, a Damani Grey, and Maris Thornhill, an Andoran Brown. Only Kerala among them had a warder, though he had turned out to be a dark friend too. Luckily, soon after learning that his Aes Sedai had betrayed him, he had managed to take poison in the basement room where he had been confined while Kerala was questioned. Strange to think of that as lucky, but the oath rod only worked on those who could channel, and they were too few to guard and tend prisoners. It had been such a bright beginning, however fraught, and now they were at an impasse unless one of the others returned to the tower, back to searching for discrepancies between what sisters claimed to have done and what it could be proven they actually had, something made harder by the inclination of most sisters to be oblique in nearly everything. Of course, Talin and the other three would pass along whatever they knew, whatever came into their hands. The oath of obedience took care of that. But any message very much more important than, take this and put it in that place, would be in a cipher known only to the woman who sent it and the woman it was directed to. Some were protected by a weave that made the ink vanish if the wrong hand broke the seal. That could be done with so little of the power it might go unnoticed unless you were looking for it, and there appeared to be no way to circumvent the ward. If they were not at an impasse, then their flow of success was reduced to a creeping trickle. And always there was the danger that the hunted would learn of them and become the hunters. Invisible hunters, for all practical purposes, just as they now seemed invisible prey. Still, they had four names plus four sisters in hand who would admit they were dark friends, though likely Maris would be as quick as the other three to claim she now rejected the shadow, repented of her sins, and embraced the light once more. Enough to convince anyone. Supposedly the Black Aja knew everything that passed in Elida's study, yet it might be worth the risk. Pavara refused to believe Talin's claim that Elida was a dark friend. After all, she had initiated the hunt. The Amarlin seat could rouse the entire tower. Perhaps a revelation that the Black Aja truly existed might do what the appearance of the rebels with an army had failed to. Stop the Ajas from hissing at one another like strange cats and bind them back together. The tower's wounds called for desperate remedies. The serving women passed beyond earshot, and Pavara was about to bring up the suggestion when Yukiri spoke again. Last night, Talin received an order to appear tonight before their Supreme Council. Her mouth twisted around the words in distaste. It seems that happens only if you're being honored or given a very, very important assignment, or if you're to be put to the question. Her lips almost writhed. What they had learned about the Black Aja's means of putting someone to the question was as nauseating as it was incredible. Forcing a woman into a circle against her will? Guiding a circle to inflict pain? Pavara felt her stomach writhing. Talin doesn't think she's to be honored or given an assignment, Yukiri went on, so she begged to be hidden away. Sayarin put her in a room in the lowest basement. Talin may be wrong, but I agree with Sayarin. Risking it would be letting a dog into the chicken yard and hoping for the best. Pavara stared up at the tapestry stretching well above their heads. Armored men swung swords and axes, stabbed spears and halberds at huge man-like shapes with boar's snouts and wolf's snouts, with goat's horns and ram's horns. The weaver had seen Trollocs, or accurate drawings. Men fought alongside the Trollocs, too. Dark friends. Sometimes fighting the shadow required spilling blood and desperate remedies. Let Talin go to this meeting, she said. We'll all go. They won't expect us. We can kill or capture them and decapitate the Black at a stroke. This Supreme Council must know the names of all of them. We can destroy the whole Black Aja.
Lifting an edge of the fringe on Pavara's shawl with a slim hand, Yukiri frowned at it ostentatiously.
Yes, red. I thought it might have turned green when I wasn't looking. There will be 13 of them, you know. Even if some of this council are out of the tower, the rest will bring in sisters to make up the number.
I know, Pavara replied impatiently. Talin had been a fount of information, most of it useless and much of it horrifying, almost more than they could take in. We take everyone. We can order Zera and the others to fight alongside us, and even Talin and that lot. They'll do as they're told.
In the beginning, she had been uneasy about that oath of obedience, but over time you could become accustomed to anything.
So, 19 of us against 13 of them, Yukiri mused, sounding much too patient. Even the way she adjusted her shawl radiated patience. Plus whoever they have watching to make sure their meeting isn't disturbed. Thieves are always the most careful of their purses.
That had the irritating sound of an old saying. Best to call the numbers even at best, and probably favoring them.
How many of us die in return for killing or capturing how many of them? More importantly, how many of them escape? Remember, they meet hooded. If just one escapes, then we won't know who she is, but she'll know us. And soon enough, the whole Black Aja will know, too. It sounds to me less like chopping off a chicken's head than like trying to wrestle a leopard in the dark.
Pavara opened her mouth, then closed it without speaking. Yukiri was right. She should have tallied the numbers and reached the same conclusion herself. But she wanted to strike out at something, at anything, and small wonder. The head of her Aja might be insane. She was tasked with arranging for Reds, who by ancient custom bonded no one, to bond not just any men, but Ashaman. And the hunt for dark friends in the tower had reached a stone wall. Strike out? She wanted to bite holes through bricks. She thought their meeting was at an end. She had come only to learn how matters progressed with Maris, and a bitter harvest that had turned out. But Yukiri touched her arm.
Walk with me a while. We've been here too long, and I want to ask you something.
Nowadays, sitters of different Ajas standing together too long made rumors of plots sprout like mushrooms after rain. For some reason, talking while walking seemed to cause many fewer. It made no sense, but there it was. Yukiri took her time getting to her question. The floor tiles turned from green and blue to yellow and brown as they walked along one of the main corridors that spiraled gently through the tower, down 5 floors without seeing anyone else before she spoke.
Has the Red heard from anyone who went with Tovain?
Pavara almost tripped over her own slippers. She should have expected it, though. Tovain would not have been the only one to write from Kyrian. From Tovain herself, she said, and told almost everything that had been in Tovain's letter. Under the circumstances, there was nothing else she could do. She did hold back the accusations against Elida, and also how long ago the letter had arrived. The one was still Aja business, she hoped, while the other might require awkward explanations.
We heard from Akura Vayet.
Yukiri walked a few paces in silence, then muttered,
Blood and bloody ashes.
Pavara's eyebrows rose in shock. Yukiri was often earthy but never vulgar before this. She noted that the other woman had not said when Akura's letter arrived either. Had the Grey received other letters from Kyrian, from sisters who had sworn to the Dragon Reborn? She could not ask. They trusted one another with their lives in this hunt, and still Aja business was Aja business.
What do you intend doing with the information?
We will keep silent for the good of the tower. Only the sitters and the head of our Aja know. Evanaline is for pulling Elida down because of this, but that can't be allowed now. With the tower to mend and the Shan Chan and Ashaman to be dealt with? Perhaps never.
She did not sound happy over that. Pavara stifled her irritation.
She could not like Elida, yet you did not have to like the Ammerlin seat. Any number of very unlikable women had worn the stole and done well for the tower. But could sending 51 sisters into captivity be called doing well? Could Dumai's Wells, with 4 sisters dead and more than 20 delivered into another sort of captivity to a Taviran? No matter. Elida was red, had been red, and far too long had passed since a red gained the stole and staff. All the rash actions and ill-considered decisions seemed things of the past since the rebels appeared, and saving the tower from the Black Aja would redeem her failures. That was not how she put it, of course. She began the hunt, Yukiri. She deserves to finish it. Light, everything we've uncovered so far has come by chance, and we are at a full stop. We need the authority of the Ammerlin seat behind us if we're to get any further. I don't know, the other woman said, wavering. All 4 of them say the Black knows everything that happened in Elida's study. She bit at her lip and shrugged uncomfortably. Perhaps if we can meet her alone, away from her study. There you are. I've been looking everywhere. Pavara turned calmly at the sudden voice behind them, but Yukiri gave a start and muttered something pungent almost under her breath. If she kept this up, she would be as bad as Doasine or Tsutama. Siane hurried down to them with the fringes of her shawl swinging and her thick black eyebrows rising in surprise at Yukiri's glare. How like a white! Logical in everything and often blind to the world around them. Half the time, Siane seemed unaware they were in any danger at all. "You were looking for us?" Yukiri almost growled, planting her fists on her hips. Despite her diminutive size, she gave a good impression of fierce looming. Doubtless part of that was for being startled, but she still believed Siane should be guarded closely for her own protection, no matter what Saren had decided, and here the woman was, out and about, alone. "For you, for Saren, for anyone," Siane replied calmly. Her earlier fears that the Black Aja might know what work Elida had assigned her were quite gone. Her blue eyes held warmth, yet otherwise she was back to being the prototypical white— a woman of icy serenity. "I have urgent news," she said, as though it were anything but. "The lesser is this. This morning I saw a letter from Ayako Norsoni that arrived several days ago from Kyrian. She and Tovain and all the others have been captured by the Ashaman, and..." Tilting her head to one side, she studied them in turn. "You aren't surprised in the slightest." "Of course. You've seen letters, too. Well, there's nothing to be done about it now, anyway." Pavara exchanged looks with Yukiri, then said, "This is the less urgent, Siane?" The white sitter's composure faded into worry, tightening her mouth and creasing the corners of her eyes. Her hands tightened into fists, gripping her shawl. "For us, it is. I've just come from answering a summons to Elida. She wanted to know how I was getting on." Siane took a deep breath. "With discovering proof that Alviarin entered a treasonous correspondence with the Dragon Reborn. Really, she was so circumspect in the beginning, so indirect, it's no wonder I misunderstood what she wanted." "I think that fox is walking on my grave," Yukiri murmured. Pavara nodded. The notion of approaching Elida had vanished like summer dew. Their one assurance that Elida was not herself Black Aja had been that she instigated the hunt for them. But since she had done no such thing, at least the Black Aja remained in ignorance of them. At least they had that, still. But for how much longer? "On mine, too," she said softly. Alviarin glided along the corridors of the lower tower with an outward air of serenity that she held on to hard. Night seemed to cling to the walls despite the mirrored stand lamps, the ghosts of shadows dancing where none should be. Imagination, surely, yet they danced on the edges of vision. The hallways were very nearly empty, though the second sitting of supper had just ended. Most sisters preferred to have food brought up to their rooms these days, but the hardier and more defiant ventured to the dining halls from time to time,
and a handful still took many of their meals below. She would not risk sisters seeing her appear flustered or hurried. She refused to let them believe she was scuttling about furtively. In truth, she disliked anyone looking at her at all. Outwardly calm, she seethed inside. Abruptly, she realized that she was fingering the spot on her forehead where Shaidar Haran had touched her, where the great lord himself had marked her as his. Hysteria bubbled almost to the surface with that thought, but she maintained a smooth face by sheer will and gathered her white silk skirts slightly. That should keep her hands occupied. The great lord had marked her. Best not to think on that. But how to avoid it? The great lord! On the outside she displayed absolute composure, but within was a swirling tangle of mortification and hatred, and very near to gibbering terror. The external calm was what mattered, though, and there was a seed of hope. That mattered, too. An odd thing to think of as hopeful, yet she would hang on to anything that might keep her alive. Stopping in front of a tapestry that showed a woman wearing an elaborate crown kneeling to some long-ago Amerlin, she pretended to examine it while glancing quickly to left and right. Aside from her, the corridor remained as barren of life as an abandoned tomb. Her hand darted behind the edge of the tapestry, and in an instant she was walking on again, clutching a folded message. A miracle that it had reached her so quickly. The paper seemed to burn her palm, but she could not read it here. At a measured pace, she climbed reluctantly to the white Aja quarters, calm and unfazed by anything, on the outside. The great lord had marked her. Other sisters were going to look at her. The white was the smallest of the Ajas, and barely more than 20 of its sisters were in the tower at present, yet it seemed that nearly all of them were out in the main hallway. The walk along the plain white floor tiles seemed like running a gauntlet. Cian and Farana were heading out despite the hour, shawls draped along their arms, and Cian gave her a small smile of commiseration, which made her want to kill the sitter, always thrusting her sharp nose in where it was unwanted. Farana held no sympathy. She scowled with more open fury than any sister should have allowed herself to show. All Alviarin could do was try to ignore the copper-skinned woman without being obvious. Short and stout, with her usually mild round face and an ink smudge on her nose, Farana was no one's image of a Damani. But the first reasoner possessed a fierce Damani temper. She was quite capable of handing down a penance for any slight, especially to a sister who had disgraced both herself and the white. The Aja felt keenly the shame of her having been stripped of the keeper's stole. Most felt anger at the loss of influence as well. There were far too many glares, some from sisters who stood far enough below her that they should leap to obey if she gave a command. Others deliberately turned their backs. She made her way through those frowns and snubs at a steady pace, unhurried, yet she felt her cheeks beginning to heat. She tried to immerse herself in the soothing nature of the white quarters. The plain white walls, lined with silvered stand mirrors, held only a few simple tapestries, images of snow-capped mountains, shady forests, stands of bamboo with sunlight slanting through them. Ever since attaining the shawl, she had used those images to help her find serenity in times of stress. The great lord had marked her. She clutched her skirts in fists to hold her hands at her sides. The message seemed to burn her hand, a steady, measured pace. Two of the sisters she passed ignored her simply because they did not see her. Estrella and Tassan were discussing food spoilage, arguing, rather. Faces smooth, but eyes heated and voices on the brink of heat. They were arithmetists of all things, as if logic could be reduced to numbers, and they seemed to be disagreeing on how those numbers were used. Calculating with Radun's standard of deviation, the rate is 11 times what it should be, Estrella said in tight tones. Furthermore, this must indicate the intervention of the shadow. Tassan cut her off, beaded braids clicking as she shook her head. The shadow, yes, but Radun's standard, it is outdated. You must use Kovanan's first rule of medians and calculate separately for rotting meat or rotten.
The correct answers, as I said, are 13 and 9. I've not yet applied it to the flour or the beans and the lentils, but it seems intuitively obvious.
Estrella swelled up, and since she was a plump woman with a formidable bosom, she could swell impressively.
Kufanen's first rule? She practically spluttered, breaking in. That hasn't been properly proven yet. Correct and proven methods are always preferable to slipshod.
Alviarin very nearly smiled as she moved on. So someone had finally noticed that the great lord had laid his hand on the tower. But knowing would not help them change matters. Perhaps she had smiled, but if so, she crushed it as someone spoke.
You'd grimace too, Ramisa, if you were being strapped every morning before breakfast, Noreen said, much too loudly, and plainly meaning for Alviarin to hear.
Ramisa, a tall, slender woman with silver bells sewn down the sleeves of her white-embroidered dress, looked startled at being addressed, and likely she was. Noreen had few friends, perhaps none. She went on, cutting her eyes toward Alviarin to see whether she had noticed.
It is irrational to call a penance private and pretend nothing is happening when the Armelin's seat has imposed it. But then her rationality has always been overrated, in my opinion.
Fortunately, Alviarin had only a short way further to reach her rooms. Carefully, she closed the outer door and latched the latch. Not that anyone would disturb her, but she had not survived by taking chances except where she had to. The lamps were lit, and a small fire burned on the white marble hearth against the cool of an early spring evening. At least the servants still performed their duties, but even the servants knew. Silent tears of humiliation began to stream down her cheeks. She wanted to kill Sylviana, yet that would only mean a new mistress of novices laying the strap across her every morning until Elida relented. Except that Elida would never relent. Killing her would be more to the point, yet such killings had to be carefully rationed. Too many unexpected deaths would cause questions, perhaps dangerous questions. Still, she had done what she could against Elida. Katarina's news of this battle was spreading through the Black Adja and beyond it already. She had overheard sisters who were not black talking of Dumai's Wells in detail, and if the details had grown in the telling, so much the better. Soon the news from the Black Tower would have diffused through the White Tower too, likely expanding in the same way. A pity that neither would be sufficient to see Elida disgraced and deposed, with those cursed rebels practically on the bridges. Yet Dumai's Wells and the disaster in Andor hanging over her head would keep her from undoing what Alviarin had done. Break the White Tower from within, she had been ordered. Plant discord and chaos in every corner of the tower. Part of her had felt pain at that command, a part of her still did. Yet her greater loyalty was to the great lord. Elida herself had made the first break in the tower, but she had shattered half of it past mending. Abruptly she realized that she was touching her forehead again and snatched her hand down. There was no mark there, nothing to feel or see. Every time she glanced into a mirror she checked in spite of herself. And yet sometimes she thought people were looking at her forehead, seeing something that escaped her own eyes. That was impossible, irrational, yet the thought crept in no matter how often she chased it away. Dashing tears from her face with the hand holding the message from the tapestry, she pulled the other two she had retrieved out of her belt pouch and went to the writing table standing against the wall. It was a plain table and unadorned like all of her furnishings, some of which she suspected might be of indifferent workmanship. A trivial matter. So long as furniture did what it was supposed to do, nothing more mattered. Dropping the three messages on the table beside a small, beaten copper bowl, she produced a key from her pouch, unlocked a brass-banded chest sitting on the floor beside the table, and sorted through the small leather-bound books inside until she found the three she needed, each protected so that the ink on the pages would vanish if any hand but hers touched them. There were far too many ciphers in use for her to keep them in memory. Losing these books would be a painful trial, replacing them arduous, hence the stout chest and the lock. A very good lock. Good locks were not trivialities. Quickly she stripped off the thin strips of paper wrapping the message recovered from behind the tapestry, held them to a lamp flame and dropped them into the bowl to burn. They were only directions as to where the message was to be left. One meant for each woman in the chain,
the extra strips merely a way of disguising how many links the message had to go through to reach its recipient. Too many precautions were an impossibility. Even the sisters of her own heart believed her no more than they. Only three on the Supreme Council knew who she was, and she would have avoided that had it been possible. There could never be too many precautions, especially now. The message, once she worked it out, bending to write on another sheet, was much as she had expected since the previous night when Talin failed to appear. The woman had left the Green Quarters early yesterday carrying fat saddlebags and a small chest. Not having a servant carry them, she had performed the task herself. No one seemed to know where she had gone. The question was, had she panicked on receiving her summons to the Supreme Council, or was there something more? Something more, Alviarin decided. Talin had looked to Eukiri and Doasine as though seeking guidance, perhaps. She was sure she had not imagined it. Could she have? A very small seed of hope. There must be something more. She needed a threat to the Black, or the Great Lord would withdraw his protection. Angrily, she pulled her hand away from her forehead. She never considered using the small Turangreal she had hidden away to call Messana. For one thing, one very important thing, the woman surely intended to kill her, very likely despite the Great Lord's protection. On the instant, if that protection were lost. She had seen Messana's face, knew of her humiliation. No woman would let that pass, especially not one of the Chosen. Every night she dreamed of killing Messana, often daydreamed of how to manage it successfully, yet that must wait on finding her without the woman knowing herself found. In the meanwhile, she needed more proof. It was possible that neither Messana nor Shaidar Haran would see Talin as verification of anything. Sisters had panicked and run in the past, if rarely, and assuming Messana and the Great Lord were ignorant of that would be dangerous. In turn, she touched the ciphered message and the clear copy to the lamp flame and held each by a corner until they had burned nearly to her fingers, before dropping them atop the ashes in the bowl. With a smooth black stone that she kept as a paperweight, she crushed the ashes and stirred them about. She doubted that anyone could reconstitute words from ash. But even so... Still standing, she deciphered the other two messages and learned that Eukiri and Doasine both slept in rooms warded against intrusion. That was unsurprising. Hardly a sister in the tower slept without warding these days, but it meant kidnapping either would be difficult. That was always easiest when carried out in the depths of the night by sisters of the woman's own Aja. It might yet turn out those glances were happenstance or imagination. She needed to consider the possibility. With a sigh, she gathered more of the small books from the chest and gently eased herself onto the goose-down cushion on the chair at the writing table. Not gently enough to stop a wince as her weight settled, though. She stifled a whimper. At first, she had thought the humiliation of Sylviana's strap far worse than the pain, but the pain no longer really faded. Her bottom was a mass of bruises, and tomorrow the Mistress of Novices would add to them, and the day after that, and the day after. A bleak vision of endless days howling under Sylviana's strap, of fighting to meet the eyes of sisters who knew all about the visits to Sylviana's study. Trying to chase those thoughts away, she dipped a good steel-nibbed pen and began to write out ciphered orders on thin sheets of paper. Talin must be found and brought back, of course, for punishment and execution, if she had simply panicked, and if she had not, if she had somehow found a way to betray her oaths. Alviarin clung to that hope while she commanded a close watch put on Eukiri and Doasine. A way had to be found to take them. And if they were caught up in chance and imagination, something could still be manufactured from whatever they said. She would guide the flows in the circle. Something could be made. She wrote furiously, unaware that her free hand had risen to her forehead, searching for the mark. Afternoon sunlight slanted through the tall trees on the ridge above the vast Shaido encampment, dappling the air, and songbirds trilled on the branches overhead. Redbirds and blue jays flashed by, slashes of color, and Galena smiled. Heavy rain had fallen in the morning, and the air still held a touch of coolness beneath sparse, slowly drifting white clouds. Likely her gray mare, with its arched neck and lively step, had been the property of a noblewoman, or at the least a wealthy merchant. No one else but a sister could have afforded such a fine animal. She enjoyed these rides on the horse she had named Swift, because one day it would carry her swiftly to freedom, just as she enjoyed this time alone to dwell on what she would do once she had her freedom. She had plans for repaying those who had failed her, beginning with Elida. Thinking about those plans, about their eventual fruition, was most enjoyable. At least she enjoyed her rides so long as she managed to forget that the privilege was as much a mark of how thoroughly Thurava owned her as were the thick white silk robe she wore and her fire-drop-studded belt and collar. Her smile faded into a grimace. Adornments for a pet that was allowed to amuse itself when not required to amuse its owner. And she could not remove those jeweled markers, even out here. Someone might see. She rode here to get away from the Aiel, yet they could be encountered in the forest, too. Thurava might learn of it. Difficult as it was to admit to herself, she feared the hawk-eyed wise one to her bones. Thurava filled her dreams, and they were never pleasant. Often she woke, sweat-soaked and weeping. Waking from those nightmares was always a relief, whether or not she managed to get any sleep for the rest of the night. There was never any order against escape on these rides, an order she would have had to obey, and that lack produced its own bitterness. Thurava knew she would return, no matter how she was mistreated, in the hope that some day the Wise One might remove that cursed oath of obedience. She would be able to channel again, when and as she wished. Savannah sometimes made her channel to perform menial tasks, or just to demonstrate that she could command it, but that occurred so seldom that she hungered for even that chance to embrace Sayadar. Thurava refused to let her so much as touch the power unless she begged and groveled, but then refused her permission to channel a thread. And she had groveled, abased herself completely, just to be granted that scrap. She realized that she was grinding her teeth and forced herself to stop. Perhaps the oath rod in the tower could lift that oath from her as well as the nearly identical rod in Thurava's possession. Yet she could not be sure. The two were not identical. It was only a difference in marking, yet what if that indicated that an oath sworn on one was particular to that rod? She dared not leave without Thurava's rod. The Wise One often left it lying in the open in her tent, but "You will never pick that up," she had said. Oh, Galena could touch that wrist-thick white rod, stroke its smooth surface. Yet however hard she strained, she could not make her hand close on it, not unless someone handed it to her. At least, she hoped that would not count as picking the thing up. It had to be so. Just the thought that it might not be filled her with bleakness. The yearning in her eyes when she gazed at the rod brought Thurava's rare smiles. "Does my little Lena want to be free of her oath?" she would say mockingly. "Then Lena must be a very good pet, because the only way I will consider freeing you is for you to convince me that you will remain my pet even then." A lifetime of being Thurava's plaything and the target for her temper? A surrogate to be beaten whenever Thurava raged against Savannah? Bleakness was not strong enough to describe her feelings on that. Horror was more like it. She feared she might go mad if that happened, and equally she feared there might be no escape into madness. Mood thoroughly soured, she shaded her eyes to check the height of the sun. Thurava had merely said that she would like her back before dark, and a good 2 hours of daylight remained. But she sighed with regret and immediately turned swift downslope through the trees toward the camp. The Wise One enjoyed finding ways to enforce obedience without direct commands, a thousand ways to make her crawl. For safety, the woman's slightest suggestion must be taken as a command. Being a few minutes late brought punishments that made Galena cringe at the memories. Cringe and heel the mare to a faster pace through the trees. Thurava accepted no excuses. Abruptly, an Aiel man stepped out in front of her from behind a thick tree, A very tall man in Karinsor, with his spears thrust through the harness that held his bow case on his back, and his veil hanging on his chest. Without speaking, he seized her bridle. For an instant she gaped at him, then drew herself up indignantly. "Fool," she snapped. "You must know me by now. Release my horse, or Savannah and Thurava will take turns removing your skin." These Aiel usually showed little on their faces, yet she thought his green eyes widened slightly, and then she screamed as he seized the front of her robe in a huge fist and jerked her from the saddle.
"Be silent, Geishine," he said,
but as though he cared nothing for whether she obeyed. At one time she would have had to, but once they realized that she obeyed an order from anyone, there had been too many who enjoyed sending her on foolish errands that kept her occupied when Thurava or Savannah wanted her. Now she need obey only certain wise ones and Savannah, so she kicked and flailed and screamed in desperate hope of attracting someone who knew she belonged to Thurava. If only she were allowed to carry a knife, even that would have been a help. How could this man not recognize her, or at least know what her jeweled belt and collar meant? The encampment was immense, as filled with people as many large cities, yet it seemed that everyone could point out Thurava's pet wetlander. The woman would have this fellow skinned, and Galena meant to enjoy every minute of watching. All too quickly it became apparent that a knife would have been no use at all. Despite her struggles, the brute handled her easily, pulling her cowl down over her head, blinding her, then stuffing as much of it as he could into her mouth before binding it there. Then he flipped her face down and bound her wrists and ankles tightly, as easily as if she had been a child. She still thrashed, but it was wasted effort.
"He wanted some guy shine that aren't a eel, Gaul. But a guy shine in silk and jewels and outriding?" a man said, and Galena stiffened.
That was no Aiel man. Those were the accents of Murundi.
"Sure, and that's none of your ways, is it? Shido."
The word was spat out like a curse.
"Well, we still need to find a few more if he's to learn anything useful. Maybe more than a few. There are tens of thousands of folks in white down there, and she could be anywhere among them."
"I think maybe this one can tell Perenebara what he needs to know, Fager Niald."
If she had stiffened before, now she froze. Ice seemed to form in her stomach and in her heart. Perenebara had sent these men? If he attacked the Shido trying to rescue his wife, he would be killed, destroying her leverage with Fael. The woman would not care what was revealed, with her man dead, and the others had no secrets they feared having known. In horror, Galena saw her hopes of obtaining the rod melting away. She had to stop him, but how?
"And why would be you thinking that, Gaul?"
"She is Aes Sedai, and a friend of Savannah, it seems."
"Is she now?" the Murandian said in a thoughtful tone. "Is she that?"